and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. How are you, lurking conservatives? Welcome to you. It's morning in Manhattan. It's Thursday morning. I'm driving to work, Riley. Well, I'm not driving. I'm being driven to work because it's 3:30 in the morning. That's what we do here because not all of us have cars. We get driven to where we work. You have a car coming in from New Jersey, but I'm coming in with my with the guy who drives me occasionally, and we come over the bridge. We're driving down, I guess, 2nd Avenue, as we always do, and all of a sudden it looks quiet. There are flashing lights down, you know, probably 30 blocks, and that's always bad when 2nd Avenue is empty. And all of a sudden, to my right, I see the cop cars stacked, cordoning off the streets, and I see just beyond that, over on 3rd Avenue, I see fire trucks as I'm going by, and it's the middle of the night here, so you have that moment where you're like, hey, what's going on over there?
Oh, yeah.
And then we get up into the office, and it seems like something's going on over there.
There was an explosion near the British Consulate, which is located, for those of you who know anything about Manhattan, around 3rd Avenue and 50th Street. This happens, of course, as Britons, as we speak, are going to the polls to vote in the parliamentary elections. Reuters is quoting a couple of news stations here in New York as saying there were two small explosions outside the building housing the British Consulate. Now, this is not a building that just houses the British. There's a bunch of other offices as well. But I think that a lot of people placed a great deal of importance on the fact that the British Consulate was housed there. No injuries have been reported. And there are no reports of structural damage inside or at the consulate.
So we're talking small explosions, some windows broken, but it's sort of a, I'll tell you, when I come over that bridge, when I cover the 59th Street Bridge every day, there's usually a few cops there, randomly searching vans.
Yeah.
And then what's amazing to me about living in New York is how quickly they can cordon off, is that the word?
Cordon off.
Sections of the city, because it is just a grid.
Yeah.
It's just pretty fascinating. Like, bam, with a couple of strategic placements of vehicles, you've got a huge, sort of square.
Yeah, seal off an entire square block. You can seal off, in some cases, as much as 5 or 6 square blocks.
Yeah, bam,
like that.
But, it got me kind of nervous, but I didn't see any smoke. There wasn't, real panic. It was just, it looked like an investigation, and clearly, it doesn't seem like these were huge explosive devices, but it'll be interesting and necessary to find out where and why they have come.
Yeah,
what is going on?
Yeah,
because you can only do so much. I mean, that's why they stop vans. You can't stop a guy with a small pipe bomb or a Molotov cocktail or who the hell knows what it was. I guess we'll find out. Kind of scary though. It's always a little scary, man.
Oh well, it is scary.
It's always a little scary when you come to work at 4 or 5 blocks away. Something blew up, Kalo. Am I right? Does that bother you at all?
Of course it does.
All right,
man. Scary.
I'm just wondering if I just wanted you to, check in, get off the button for a second.
It's fortunate it wasn't over like a major subway line or something, because then you would have had to have closed down the train.
No.
And that would have made it, if it had happened one block further over, that means they would have cordoned off. They wouldn't have allowed subways to run underneath it while they were checking for the structural damage, which means this morning's rush hour here in New York would be a complete an utter mess.
Yeah, and believe me, the subways here don't need any more incentive to stop service for weird reasons.
Okay? Absolutely.
Yesterday, I'm on the train. Yesterday, I'd get on, I don't remember, what the hell train was at the N train, and bam, there's a switching problem, so they're backed up. So that means I can't get to Queens unless I take the 7 train that way. And, of course, my wife comes up with the idea, let's take a cab. Great, let's take a cab at 4 in the afternoon. So I don't know what the hell I was thinking, because you never should get off the train. Stay on the train, get on the other train. It's always going to be faster. So now, meanwhile, because around 4 o'clock, that's when I'm starting to freak out and crash from the weird schedule we have.
Yes,
sort of like, I just want to be home around my thing so I can sit down. So it's coming up on that hour, and there I am standing in front of Bloomingdale screaming because all the cabs are going off duty at that time. This is ridiculous.
Shift change. You never try to find a cab at 4 o'clock in New York because they all change shifts then.
It was so close, man. One pulled up right on time, right before I started blaming my wife. Yeah, yeah. It was like we were seconds away from me saying, why'd you make us get off the train? You never get off the train. But then I realized the ulterior motive. She almost pulled it off, but she didn't. You know, this birthday that happened 2 weeks ago, still going on. Okay, there's still the outstanding, there's still the purse issue.
And you were stuck in front of?
Bloomingdale's.
Ka-ching!
But that's like, I can't bring that up. I don't, you know, I'm not blaming her, but, you know, we're getting off the train right at the entrance of Bloomingdale's. I'm cranky, I'm tired, I'm hitting that wall, and she says, there is a person in Bloomingdale's that I kind of wanted to look at, and I was just sort of like, can you do it later? Let's just go get a cab. And now I feel bad. I got to take care of this purse issue. Speaking of issues and marital possibilities, was your girlfriend listening to the show, Kalo, yesterday?
No, she wasn't.
Lucky you.
Did you put any more thought into that?
Oh, yeah, you know, give it some thought. You know, yeah. I'm chewing on it, and, you know, I'm probably not going to be doing it, you know, anytime soon.
Ooh, he listened to Julia.
Who do I know? Someone's getting married soon. I can't.
P.W. McDonald?
Yes, Brendan P.W. McDonald.
No. Yeah, when is that? He's gonna. I haven't gotten an invitation. I
think it's next year.
Next year.
Next year, sometime. Yes.
He's gonna keep saying October. To make sure I don't show up at the wedding.
By the way, I have to tell the audience, Marin, you played some music this morning that
will
not get out of my head.
I don't know what to say.
I say this because I'm an old fan of, and I mean old fan of, a group called the Fugs. Any of you who are, you know, proto hippies, you know who I'm talking about. And Marin, did somebody send us that CD?
Yeah, it just came in the mail. I've been hearing about the Fugs for years. I read Ed Sanders, who was in the Fugs. I read his book on the Manson. He wrote the greatest book on the Mansons called The Family.
Yeah.
And he's been sort of in the subculture from the 60s for years, but I never really heard the Fugs.
Well, we heard the Fugs this morning.
Get out of here.
And they have a song called The Ten Commandments by God. It's just, thou shalt not kill. And I keep hearing that in my head now. I'm going to hear it all morning.
Thou shalt not covet your neighbors.
There you go. Kayla was reaching for the dump button.
Yeah, I don't think
just in case.
I think we can even say that one, don't we?
Actually, we can, because it is one of the commandments.
But I don't think it, I think it's a rephrasing. So we can say that? Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not covet your neighbor's ass.
Yeah. They're talking about donkeys.
Yeah, that's right. That could be. Is that what, really?
Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ox or thy neighbor's ass.
Oh, but see, I think the Fugs meant something else.
That's a little double entendre, perhaps.
I show my ignorance. You know, I've recently started to say, like, you know, maybe you should educate yourself about religion before you talk about it. And there's part of me that's sort of like, why? Why? I'm doing fine without it. Can't you tell? Here's some interesting things about wives. You know, I get this yesterday. My wife is walking through Queens, okay? And she says, here's how this story starts. This is always a good story. And a construction guy came up to me.
Oh, boy.
He's got work boots on. He's got, you know, sort of kind of guy might be wearing a union T-shirt. And then she follows it with this. Those kind of guys always like me. Right? And she's telling me the story. And I'm like, okay. And she goes, I'm carrying an Air America bag because I'm going to return the Linksys router because it didn't work or whatever. It doesn't matter. Why do you even bring that part up? She's got an Air America bag because she's returning something to a store. And apparently the guy who likes her, the union guy, the construction guy, goes, Air America, that's a great station. Now, here's the big question, Chris. Here you go. My wife say, my husband hosts a show on that station. Do you listen to it? Did she say that?
Oh, of course not.
No.
She said, do you ever listen to the morning show? You know, but, you know, why wouldn't she say my husband? You know, all right, so she says, do you ever listen to the morning show? You see what's going on?
She wants the door open, I
think.
Yeah, I know. What, right? Right, those are the
options. Options. It's on the computer.
And I'm going out of town today.
Oh.
For 2 days. But no, she's not. I don't know. But look. So she goes, do you ever listen to the morning show? And that guy goes, I'm sorry, Riley. He goes, oh, yeah, Mark and the old guy.
See? Where is he? Where is the construction site? I got to have a conversation with this chump.
And then my wife goes, you know, Mark lives around here. And the guy goes, yeah, he lives, like, right across from Marino's Fish. So the word is out, man. But then you had a situation. Your wife was out in the world, and
My wife was out in the world. She was at a hospital getting something done, something looked at or whatever. And you know, she's filling out some paperwork, and under husband's employment, she puts Air America Radio. And the woman that was actually processing the information, Air America Radio.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. So, oh, you know, my son listens to you, to Air America all the time. And then she said, well, you know, my husband hosts a morning show, unlike Mishnah.
My sleeping wife.
And then, you know, he listens to that, but he listens to Morning Tradition all the time. Oh. So we're out here in the ether, man.
That's right. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to come back. We're going to talk about Al-Qaeda's number three has been arrested. This guy, Al-Libi, immediately claimed his innocence and swore he'd devote the rest of his life to finding the real killers.
Yeah, sure.
So we'll be back at 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Charles Barkley. When I want to get caught up on the world events and I can't get in touch with Shaq, MJ, Larry, or Manute Bol, I turn to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You qualify to dramatically reduce your tax debt. Call 800-661-0491 right now. That's 800-661-0491. Call right now.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. Got an update. You know, as I was coming to work, I saw some problems. I'm coming down 2nd Avenue. I'm looking over at 3rd Avenue. There's fire trucks, police cars, blocked off streets. It's interesting, you know, now that we found out here, there were some explosions in front of the British consulate. Apparently two explosions, Riley.
Two small explosions inside a cement flower box. Now, mind you, they put these cement flower boxes in front of these consulates to prevent a car or any kind of a car bomb.
Thinly disguised barricades.
Yes, barricades. Yeah. Very thinly disguised, yeah. Although they make it impossible for people to walk up and down the street.
The beautiful concrete flower boxes.
Yeah, with, you know, done by crystal.
Yeah, exactly.
Unbelievable. But, yeah, what they have now is two small makeshift grenades, and apparently they were toy grenades that had been altered to explode by the addition of gunpowder, which sounds as if they really didn't intend to, you know, cause serious structural damage. But the police are still piecing together the shrapnel.
If they did, expect to cause serious structural damage, they were not that bright.
No, not that bright. Now, I don't know what this means in terms of the British vote, which is at this point, what is it, almost 11:30 in England. I don't know whether it's going to make much of a difference. Whether they were just doing it to to make a particular point on the day of the British general election. You never know with these things.
Yeah, well, we'll see who takes responsibility for it. I guess that's what we've got to listen for now. But I think I hear the sound of New Yorkers in their cars going, all right, we figured it out. Let's clear the road.
Yeah. Come on, I got to get to work, all right?
Oh, my God.
I'm doing 6:30.
Yeah. So now let's talk a little bit about this. First of all, before we get into the Al-Qaeda number three guy, this guy, Faraj Al, I don't want to screw up his name.
Abu Faraj Al-Libi.
Who was one of the organizers. He was one of the operational planners for much of the global terrorism that Al-Qaeda is responsible for, also some of the assassination attempts on Pakistani Prime Minister Musharraf. Now, what I want to know, Kayla, we're talking about before my wife saying that construction workers always attracted to her, and then Brendan, P.W. McDonald, comes into, isn't that what they're supposed to do? They're at construction sites. They're attracted. They'd be anybody. You know, so now you tell me this thing that you were keeping secret, apparently.
Well, I wasn't keeping it a secret. It's just that
we didn't get to it?
Yeah.
All right.
There's a construction site across the street from my house.
Right.
And my girlfriend leaves work every day at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And she gets harassed. She told me this last week. She gets harassed every day. Yeah.
Hey, baby!
Yelling. And I'm like, really? Like, this really still happens? Like, it's such a bad stereotype.
Are you referring back to the movement where there was a big sort of movement within the construction workers union to stop that from happening? Because it is surprising that it still happens.
It failed. It's as simple as that. It didn't work.
It still happens. Like, there's some point of reference for that. Didn't they stop that for a while, the construction workers?
Yeah, 15 minutes.
So what? This is what amazes me. So you did what?
Well, I walk across the street and I'm like, hey guys, I understand that my girlfriend leaves the house in the morning and you guys whistle and scream at her. And I was like, can you guys like stop doing this? And they're like, oh, you know, I'm really sorry. Like, we didn't know she was your girlfriend and everything. Like, and I was like, that's no reason to stop. Like, you should stop because you shouldn't whistle and scream at women on the street. It's just not, you know, what you should do. And they were like, all right, hey, man, look, we're really sorry. And I was like, well, thank you very much.
Did one of them start crying or anything?
No.
And as Chris walked away, you hear...
Hey, nice.
Hey.
Nice. They were very nice gentlemen.
Oh, yeah.
But who acts like that? Come on.
My experience.
Who acts like that?
Yes.
Construction workers.
Construction workers.
It's part of their job. It's
synonymous with construction.
It's in the union agreement. No, you're right. You're right, Chris. And I tell you, I've met some nice construction guys. One time when I lived up in Somerville, there was a bunch of construction guys across the street working on the house, and I had a kitten at that time. I always have kittens of some sort, but I couldn't keep hold of this one. And it got out, and then one day there's a knock on the door, and there's this huge construction guy holding this little kitten. He's got a tool belt on. He's like, "Hey, is this someone's cat?"
Hey.
He ended up taking the cat home and giving it to his wife because he thought it was a stray. And then I was outside looking around for this cat, and he brought it back to me. He goes, "I'm sorry, I did my wife, you know, here you go." But I think he ended up getting it anyways because I had an evil roommate at that time who lived in the attic and read Hitler books. I think he let the cat out. He kept letting it out. It was a kitten. I think that guy, Scott. You know, I don't want to get into this.
That's a whole other
guy
story.
Who read what?
This guy was out of his mind. This guy lived, he was a roommate of mine. He thought he was a genius. So he used to, you know, sit in his room and smoke pot and, you know, read Hitler books and read Brian Jones biography.
Now is he working in the Bush cabinet somewhere?
Dude, I don't know where that guy is. He used to work at a record store. He wasn't a Nazi. He just thought it made him interesting to read all the dark, weird books.
Ooh.
But so let's talk about this guy, because this is a pretty big capture. He's been on the most wanted list in Pakistan since day one. Apparently, he was the third under Osama bin Laden. This is a real guy. And if you look at his pictures, why do these guys always have to look like that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? They look exactly like terrorists. Am I wrong?
Well, I mean, you know, when they catch them after shootouts, I guess they do. But there's something in the story, Mark, that's giving me a little bit of pause about exactly how big a wheel this guy is. Mm-hmm. All right. We're talking, of course, about Abu Faraj al-Libi. He is apparently of Libyan extraction. Mm-hmm. But a guy from the Congressional Research Service, a terrorism expert named Kenneth Katzman, says the following.
Yeah.
However, I note with interest that last year when the Pakistanis were on his trail or looking intently, they didn't indicate he was quite the kingpin as he is now that they captured him. There may be some grade inflation going on.
Right. Well, I guess they say that of any terrorist that they capture initially. It's like, this guy was like the mastermind of all of it.
All of it, yeah. He did it. It was him. Well, this guy is alleged to have plotted a couple of assassination attempts against Pervez Musharraf, which means, by the way, that he possibly faces a death penalty if he's tried and convicted in Pakistan.
So I guess after a few days we'll find out whether he really did do these things or he was just the intern.
You know what the appeals process is in Pakistan? You're done.
Yeah, it's over.
Yep.
The Al-Qaeda intern. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the shift in the Lindy England trial. Apparently, she might be mentally incompetent, which means that the closer she gets to being declared that, the closer Bush gets to being able to execute her.
Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Being afraid of life and being afraid of death. Where the hell does that leave you?
The Mike Molloy Show on Air America Radio.
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
October 15, 1982. Today at a briefing, a reporter asked my press secretary, Larry Speaks, about the gay plague. Larry said, "I don't have it, do you?" Everybody laughed. Well, ain't this funny? Uh-oh, there are trees outside my office. Those leafy culprits are responsible for 90% of the world's pollution.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It is Morning Sedition. It is Air America. Later in today's show, we are going to be talking to Stephen Beauchamp. Is that his correct name? I don't want to screw that up.
I believe it's Keith.
Keith, is it Keith? Why don't I have it right in front of me? I'm a moron.
Yes, it's Keith.
Keith Beauchamp. He wrote and directed and created, he did the documentary film, The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till. And this film provoked the reopening of the case, and we have news today that his body, the 14-year-old Emmett Till's body, who was brutally beaten and killed in Mississippi.
A half century ago.
They're reopening this case because this documentary provoked such a, you know,
interest and made people realize that there were still people out there that were part of this.
Oh, yeah. Including, by the way, five black people.
How
who were part
figure?
Of the conspiracy to kill Emmett Till. We got to ask Keith Beauchamp. He actually went out and did the research. He wasn't just documenting what happened to Emmett Till. He interviewed dozens of witnesses, poured over literally hundreds of court transcripts, court records, police records, the whole nine yards, and set out to make a documentary whose end result would be the reopening of the case. And this is an extraordinary accomplishment by this young guy.
Well, this is what happens when you have good journalism, when you have truth that is unknown and put out into the world, and it provokes. That is exactly what documentary filmmaking should do.
Absolutely.
Also in the show, oddly, we have a secret relationship with Lou Dobbs here at this show. When we come
yes.
in every day at about 4 a.m., a repeat of his show is on in our office because we have CNN on with no sound. And we just assume that all he's doing is sitting there going, I think my cameraman is being replaced by a Mexican. What
yep.
is going on in here? It almost as if Lou Dobbs is doing a show from the Alamo every day.
Yeah.
He is completely obsessed with immigrants who are here unregistered or illegally, and we want to talk to him about it because there's certainly two sides to this issue, and many progressives, many liberals have problems with it as well, and there doesn't seem to be a solid ground as to how everybody, you know, one side thinks this way, the other side thinks this way. We got emails just from our promo.
Oh, yeah, there's a wide diversity of opinion on this. I think in Lou Dobbs' case, even though we don't actually watch him with the sound up, you could very quickly come to the conclusion that he's only concerned with Mexican immigration and
it,
no one else on the planet. But we'll get into that with him.
Yeah, we're going to deal with the issue of Lou Dobbs' potential race problem with Mexicans when he gets on. And I don't know if he's listening now, but Lou, we don't hate you. We just want to have a conversation.
Right.
We want to say hello to our new affiliate in Columbia, South Carolina, WOIC, 1230 AM Progressive Talk. Good morning, South Carolina.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure to be there. Also, later in the show, director Paul Haggis, who also wrote the screenplay for Million Dollar Baby, he's going to discuss his new movie, Crash.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be here. Very exciting show. Also, we've got, I'm going to be in Cincinnati doing the show from Cincinnati tomorrow, Mark. That's going to
you
be
are?
Yes, I'm sorry, buddy.
I quit.
Yo, you're not even going to know I'm there, apparently.
Oh, that's right.
The technology is so good.
Yes.
They're actually going to bring a dummy in and sit here in this chair, and they're going to have it coming. The sound of me is going to be coming,
coming out of my. Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah,
okay.
So
I won't miss you at all.
That's exactly right.
So get out.
Okay, I'll leave now. Here I go. So here, this is interesting, too. We had Judd Legum on the show last week. He's from the Center for American Progress.
Right.
And he was pushing the www.dropthehammer.org, which was encouraging people to rally to get Verizon, American Airlines, and Nissan America, North America to stop funding or giving money to Tom DeLay's defense fund. And apparently there was an announcement today that it was a success.
Really?
I'm not taking responsibility for this. I mean, we did what we could to help promote the site, but apparently the Fort Worth-based American Airlines, Verizon, Nissan North America, all of which collectively gave $15,000 to the Texas Republican Tom DeLay since 2000, have all sort of vouched to not do that.
And you've got two sitting members of the Ethics Committee, two Republican members of the Ethics Committee, Cole from Oklahoma and Smith from Texas, who have recused themselves from the DeLay investigation because they, too, gave money to DeLay's defense committee to the tune of $5,000 each.
Well, that interests me, Mark, because that was one of the reasons they were there. I mean, that's the way that DeLay stacked the deck in his favor. So now does this mean with these guys recusing themselves that if the Democrats stay on the same page, they can outvote the Republicans in terms of reprimanding or possibly making a justifiable charge of ethics violation stick against DeLay?
Well, here's what we have. You have an ethics committee that was deliberately balanced 5-5 between Democrats and Republicans, 10 members of the committee.
Mm-hmm.
You take away those two, it becomes 5-3 in favor of the Democrats. I don't know how, if they find something to hang their hats on with DeLay, and I don't know how they could investigate him seriously or not, but that's just me. It would seem that it would be a meatball that the investigation would have to go forward.
Well, we'll see what happens. Also, we're staying on top of a story that's literally five or or six blocks away from where we are right now, two grenades, small grenades, exploded outside the British consulate right here in New York City in a large barricade-like flower pot set up out in front. No real damage. No one was hurt. Couple broken windows. Don't know who did it. We're staying on top of that. I did want to mention also that I will be playing at Go Bananas in Cincinnati tomorrow night, or Thursday. That's tomorrow. Today's Thursday.
Today's Thursday.
Stick with it, Marin. Come on, stay on it. Friday and Saturday night, four shows if you want to get information on that, morningsedition.com. So now, moving into this Lindy England plea, this is very interesting because now her mental, not stability, but she might be retarded, apparently, or mentally challenged. I'm sorry, sometimes that word, you know, me and that word, I have a weird relationship with that word. Is being challenged, and also there is the possibility that she's lying in the sense that she might not be guilty. She might have been sort of pushed to cop a plea because Charles Grainer, is giving a different story.
Well, you can call Charles Grainer convict. He's doing 10 years for his role in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. He also was in the uncomfortable position of having his ex-wife, the mother of his child, allegedly, and his current wife, who, by the way, has also been convicted on charges relating to this, all in the same courtroom at the same time. But what he did was continue to allege that Lindy England essentially did what he told her to do. He was her superior technically, which would then say that she didn't know that what she was doing was illegal because it came as a direct result of something that was said by a superior.
I tell you, I don't know if they're thinking about this up in Ohio, but I think that this is a great this is a great episode for Springer's radio show because he can do what he's used to and also cover progressive causes. I think he should go down to this trial because between Grainer's two wives, Lindy England, I don't know. That sounds exactly like something that could really work towards both the Jerry Strong suits.
Yeah, now the military judge in this case, Colonel James Pohl, essentially rejected the plea to the conspiracy charge that Lindy England had copped to, and that canceled the entire plea agreement. The agreement carried a maximum sentence of 11 years, but the prosecution and defense had made a deal that some people said would subject Lindy England to no more than 2 years in prison. That's all off the table now, and there's a very real question about how the military will proceed from here, because this is not something that happens every day in court-martial proceedings or in military trials. The next step would be the equivalent of a grand jury, which means essentially they're going back to square one here.
So Grainer is saying that not only was the leash around the guy's neck just a slip of the leash, that he was following procedure in harnessing this guy the way he used to harness people in the prison that he worked at. But he was saying that literally they were taking the pictures as a sort of instructional tape. Now, I mean, my question here, Riley, is if they let Lindy England off the hook for just being, you know, stupid and doing what she was told by this other moron. Now, because he was saying that it was procedural or that he was actually doing something to teach other soldiers how to do something properly or improperly, is there any chance that we can start going up the chain of command here?
There is a chance, but, you know, the way the military operates, the further up the chain of command you go, the better the people involved are at covering their own behinds.
Mm.
We've seen that happen in, you know, as a case in point, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. You know, Grainer wasn't a colonel. He was a sergeant. Lindy England was a corporal or private or whatever. These are not the people at the top of the food chain here. And at some point, someone is going to have to answer for the notion that the military people were encouraged to do this by someone. It wasn't Janice Karpinski necessarily. She's about the only high-ranking officer that's gotten any flack over any of this.
Right.
The question is, where are these civilian CIA/FBI, whoever, military interrogators who helped create the climate that allowed this stuff to take place? Well, we don't even know their names.
Right. The suits that came in and out that Karpinski just said, Hi, fellas, do you have any ideas?
It's down there.
Oh, I guess they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But how about this? One of the charges, which could have added 5 years additional jail time, alleged that Lindy England engaged in an indecent act by engaging in fellatio with Grainer and allowing another soldier to photograph the exploits. I mean, how's he going to rationalize that one?
Is that for prisoner handling technique as well?
Well, that was the one question, is, or maybe it was just an actual torture torture device, the two of them having sex, the prisoners are like, oh, my God.
I confess I did it.
That's disgusting. I give. I break. All right, 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
On the 90-day trial guarantee. Call 1-877-289-9200. That's 1-877-289-9200.
49 past the hour, Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition. How will Paula Abdul react and with the rest of the American Idol crew to these allegations? That was the lead, Riley. Here we got a bomb. A bomb goes off in New York. That's all we know. I'm coming to work. I see fire trucks. This is 5 blocks away. I'm like, what the hell happened? We turn on the TV. We see a CNN live news break. They're crediting the feed for WABC. And this is the breaking news that something exploded a few blocks from here. Okay, don't get freaked out, people. It was 2 small grenades. Nobody's hurt. Not much structural damage. A couple windows broken. Don't know who did it. All right? But we're looking around the dial. We figure, okay, if this is credited to WABC, let's go to the ABC affiliate. Bang. We go to the ABC affiliate. What will happen on American Idol?
Yeah.
Where's the bombs? Now, this is a big problem because we talked about this the other day. The irresponsibility. There is no liberal media. There is a ridiculous, stupid, irresponsible media. There's the right, and then there's the garbage. That's what we have in this country, garbage. They're just trying to get people to watch. It's unbelievable with the runaway bride thing. We were talking about that the other day. The reason people were angry was not because that they were wasting our time with that stupid story. It was actually because she didn't show up dead. That was why people got upset. They felt duped. Why couldn't you have been dead? You shouldn't be alive. You fooled us. And I can believe me, CNN, all the major news outlets, all the major morning shows really aggravated because they thought they had about 2 months of programming, not including the court case, in the can.
Well, you got the Michael Jackson trial. You got the runaway bride. You watch what they do with Lindy England. I got a TV movie I'm thinking is going to be out pretty soon about that whole situation. I mean, when you start looking at all, there are all of these, and the media tends to pick up on the most salacious aspects of all this. Now, again, Paula Abdul, if she had been, you know, if it had simply been a situation where they alleged that she maybe helped coach the guy or whatever, what attracts people to this is the allegation of an affair.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be, like, there was a time where the Today Show had news. I remember when I was a kid, my mother used to watch the Today Show every morning. You got news. You got, you know, what's going on in Vietnam? Where are we at in the world? You know, now it's almost like the news is just this little section, and they got animal stories. For God's sakes, Riley, 3 days with that giant hamburger, all right? For 3 days, some restaurant down, well, I don't even know where
Pennsylvania.
The hell it is, in Pennsylvania, made some 25-pound hamburger, and I saw that on television no less than 10 times over 3 days period. The runaway bride thing, it's ridiculous. And now, along the same lines, first of all, this is it's worse than pornography, all right? Because
worse?
Yes, especially because the American Idol thing. These are marginally talented people that, if anything...
You mean the judges?
All of them. All of them. They're washed up. They're has-beens. Who cares? And the people that, you know, are even doing it, a lot of times I'm sure it's rigged, number one. Of course it is. They're all rigged. It's been rigged since the $64,000 question. Nothing has changed. You know, people are just stupid. I mean, people, they don't care if it's rigged. They just like the game. Look at the election. All right, so what you have here...
You're rough.
Well, but it's true. It's like you have... This is not even great entertainment. They just like the spirit of it, that these people aren't professionals, that these people and the judges are sort of washed up losers. They're just like us in some respects. Pornography, one of the greatest things anyone ever said to me after I spent an afternoon, this was years ago, watching porn. All right? My friend.
You noticed that caveat, ladies and
sure
gentlemen.
Sure, I did.
Years ago.
My friend Louis C.K. is a very brilliant comedian. He says to me.
I saw a movie of his the other day.
He did Pootie Tang.
No, he did a short.
Yes,
he's
done many
shorts. A really bizarre short.
He's a very bizarre guy.
Yes.
Well, I told him about this porn thing, and he's not without his demons, but he says to me, he says, what do you want to waste time watching losers? You know, and I realized that's all of it.
That's, I mean, that's American Idol. That's all of it. But they're not even having sex. You know, it's just it's.
That's what you say.
Okay, but maybe now apparently there are allegations. But is there tape?
Yeah. You know, well, no, no tape. Although you never know, somebody could make a bundle of money that way.
It's a big publicity scam. They're taking advantage of us. That's all they do. You know, this whole, you know, the Tom Cruise, Kate, what's her name?
Katie, what's her name?
Yeah, what's her
name? Katie Holmes.
Yeah, that's BS. I mean, come on, that's a publicity scam. That they're not going out. She's, I mean, they're just trying to sell movies. They're taking advantage of us. And this morning TV stuff, look at, you watch the Today Show, they've got the sheeple pen where they just got these little people, you know, in the pen in the morning outside going, look at me, look, look, I knitted a hat. You know, I mean, what is that?
It is
the end of the world, Riley.
Modern journalism, modern television. It is, unfortunately, we get what we ask for.
Do we?
Yeah.
Do we
got just... American Idol, you know, who my daughter. My daughter's 8 years old. She's got an excuse for watching that crap.
Why?
I have never, because she's eight.
Oh,
okay. Because she's a kid, and it's entertainment for her, but it's not entertainment for me. I have never watched a single minute of American Idol, and I never will. I have never watched Fear Factor. I've never watched any of these reality shows, and you know why? Because they take legitimate, talented actors, and they get rid of them to save money by putting these people on, and it drives down the cost of production. It's union busting is what it is.
It's union busting. It's also, it's meddling with the talent gene pool. Now, I don't want to sound like a metaphoric eugenics person, but, you know, not everybody can do anything. You know, there are talented people.
Are you sure? Did somebody tell Paula Abdul that?
No, yeah, obviously. She's now a judge on American Idol. All right? But I just think it goes along the same lines as I don't think it is what people want. And the reason I think what we can deduce from your argument is on some level, most people are eight, you know, either mentally, emotionally, their expectations are that of an 8 year old. I mean, sure, Vivica is having a great time,
yeah.
But someone 40 years old shouldn't be eight.
Well,
you
no.
know, so they are, you know, they are infantilizing everybody with this garbage.
Well, there's stuff on for 40 year olds.
Yeah.
Wrestling.
Yeah, right. That's right. Springer,
there you go.
But I just, I find it contemptuous, and now the conservatives are infiltrating PBS, and they're trying to gut that of any content. I just don't know. It's almost like the construction of the hyper-reality, of the false, of the illusion, is almost complete. And what we're going to have to do to bevel into that and find any sort of amount of truth is, it's already difficult. You have to go to a bunch of different resources. You have to go to blogs. You have to talk to people. You have to listen to us. It's just going to be more and more difficult to figure out to fight the illusion. 50% of the people in this country finally believe that George Bush lied about why we went to war in Iraq. What about the other 50%? I'll tell you about it. They're stupid. That's 50%.
Well, they're busy sleeping.
They're busy watching garbage. They're busy watching The Hamburger. They're busy going to James Dobson lectures. They're busy, you know, immersing themselves in crap, in lies, to buttress their denial, to maintain their point of view. And it's a shame.
Well, it is a shame, but it is not irreparable. There, you know, once you start trying in incremental steps, because all of this is happening in incremental steps, once we start changing the terms of the conversation, hopefully we'll get some folks to listen, some folks to pay attention, some folks to, you know, watch some good PBS instead of watching all of this crap.
And when we come back, Keith Beauchamp, the documentary filmmaker who made the untold story of Emmett Lewis Till, will tell us about, you know, what the truth is capable of, what it can provoke in people.
That's right. Serious news when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Keeping you up to speed just a few blocks from here, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. A couple of grenades went off in front of the British consulate. Now, I wasn't, like, I was coming in, I saw the sirens, I saw them, they blocked off streets. It's amazing in New York. They could block off a couple of streets and no one would even know what the hell was going on. And we turn on the TVs here. But Brendan, you were here what time? Like four? So you didn't hear nothing. That's weird. Because, you know, I would have thought that you would hear, if they were huge bombs, which they weren't, thank God. No one was hurt. Some windows were broken. Don't know who did it. There were a couple of grenades that were rigged to go off in these large barricade-like planters that they have out in front of buildings that aren't really fooling anybody, but it doesn't matter. They're there to protect it from drive-on bombs. So we'll follow that story, but it's right down the street. I'm surprised that we didn't hear anything because I didn't hear anything. I just saw the cops.
I didn't hear it. I was like three quarters of the way down, and of course I was about four blocks east of where this took place.
Yeah, well, thank God no one was hurt.
Yeah.
I am going to Cincinnati this afternoon. I've got to figure out something to do because I'm going to be doing the show from Cincinnati tomorrow, Riley.
Yeah.
For our listeners up there at 1530 WCKY, the Revolution of Talk Radio. I'm going to be doing that over a special super-duper, an ISDN line with Riley here in the studio, but I'm going to have to go out tonight in Cincinnati. Pashman says I got to go out some chili and spaghetti or something. He says that this is the one thing Pashman, you know, of course Dan Pashman would know this kind of stuff. He's like, oh, you got to have the chili.
And I'm in like, Cincinnati.
Yeah, I got to have the chili in Cincinnati. I'm like, I'm not eating meat, you know. He's like, I'm sure they make it vegetarian, but apparently they have this chili that they eat with pasta. I don't know what the hell that is, but I'm going to go give it a try. Hopefully, my hosts will take me out so I can have some sort of Cincinnati indigenous experience up there to bring back to the people of New York. Also, I want to congratulate, we had this, Judd Legum was on our show from the Center for American Progress last week, and he was pushing this www.dropthehammer.org, which was a petition, a site to sort of, push Verizon, Nissan North America, and American Airlines to not give Tom DeLay's Legal Defense Fund any money. They had given about $15,000 between the three of them since 2000,
yes.
Since the year 2000. And all of them made statements yesterday, or this morning we got these statements, that they will no longer contribute. So this is where you got to hit these guys. This is where it really hurts. I mean, DeLay says it doesn't bother him, but just the fact that people mobilized and actually were able to successfully threaten a boycott or push moneyed corporations to not get politically aligned with people we don't believe in, which is corrupt politicians, I think is a great sign of hope and is a great sign. You know, obviously we can't boycott everything that comes from bad corporations. We can try. You can do as many as you can, but it's a tall order that could take up your entire day, or unless you just move up to the farmhouse. But,
well, look, there are ways to, consciously consume, to consciously invest, and it's the same as watching TV. You don't have to watch American Idol and Fear Factor. There are other things that are on that are, can be quasi-interesting at times.
Okay, well, later in the show, we've got Lou Dobbs, who, we have not a love-hate relationship with, but he's on every morning when we get here, and he's kind of, I find him oddly engaging, and we need to ask him about his issue with primarily Mexicans.
Yeah.
And we also have the screenwriter and director, Paul Haggis, who's going to be in studio in a while, who wrote Million Dollar Baby, and we'll discuss his new film, Crash. And coming up next, though, after we go to break, is Keith Beauchamp. He's a documentary filmmaker who made the untold story of Emmett Lewis Till, and they are reopening that case and exhuming the body of Emmett Lewis Till to tie up the loose ends on this horrible murder case that I got to plead ignorance here, Riley, and I'm sort of ashamed of it, but I really didn't know about this, and this is this has mythic proportion in the black community, and I'm ignorant, and I want to know your experience with it, and I want to know the facts.
Okay, I was 4 years old when Emmett Till was killed. This was in 1955. In a small Mississippi town where Emmett Till had gone to visit his aunt and uncle. The story has been told through the years, he apparently was out going to a store or something, saw a white woman and whistled and allegedly said something like, "Hey, baby." Now, Emmett Till was raised in Chicago. I think this was his first trip south. He was 14 years old at the time. Subsequent to that incident, he was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered, and his body thrown in the, I believe it was the Tallahatchie River, where they later found the body. There were two white men who were arrested, tried, and very quickly acquitted on charges of murdering Emmett Till. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, who died in 2003, specifically demanded that his casket remain open so that people could see the violence that had been brought on her son. And it sent shockwaves throughout the world. The international press picked it up. Le Monde did a huge article about it. But what I think it did for a lot of young black people, certainly I heard about Emmett Till as a very young man, hearing my parents discuss it, was the notion that, you know, you did not get too far out of line. Which was exactly the purpose that these racists had for murdering him in the first place. This was not a new procedure in terms of bringing violence against anyone that, quote, tried to desecrate or tried to belittle white womanhood. That was the whole point of this.
And this had been around since...
Since the end of Reconstruction.
Yeah, and now this is a horrifying story because this apparently was a group of kids. Emmett Till was one of them, and they were walking by, you know, this meat market in the grocery owned by Roy and Carolyn Bryant. And the story goes is that Emmett, you know, whistled at Carolyn Bryant, and then, you know, later in the night, Roy Bryant, this woman's husband, and his half brother J.W. Malam, they kidnap Emmett from his uncle's house. And basically, you know, beat him almost to death, shoot him in the head, and throw him in the Tallahassee River. Now, that happening in and of itself, you know, is horrifying. But the fact that, you know, they went on trial and a jury, you know, let them off in just over an hour. And one of the jurors made a joke afterwards that they could have done it in a shorter amount of time if they hadn't had to eat lunch or something like that. And that happened in this country is devastating to me, and it's like I can't wrap my brain around it. Now, at the time, did this galvanize the civil rights movement? Because this was earlier than that. So what this really succeeded in doing, from what you told me yesterday, is scaring the crap out of black kids and black people in general in this country.
Well, it did. But it also did have the effect of galvanizing the civil rights movement. 100 days after Emmett Till was murdered, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat in a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and the modern civil rights movement really kicked off. This was during that hammock period between the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision and Rosa Parks' action that really kicked off the civil rights movement. And it was a tremendous catalyst, I think, for a lot of activity, particularly in the South.
Yeah, and this happened so much earlier than some of the civil rights-related deaths that we know of, that, you know, the civil rights workers.
Goodman Cheney and Schwerner and Medgar Evers and people like that.
But I think what's fascinating about what you were saying before in terms of how you were 4 years old and what this did on a national level as it took this sort of, you know, mythic proportion in the black community was it scared the hell out of kids. You know, this kid was 14, you know, and when you are old enough to think and you realize that kind of horrible event happened to a kid that's just a couple years older than you, you know, it completely paralyzes you with fear at every turn.
Well, yeah, because what it did was say that racists in America at that time were not above slaughtering children to get their point across. And that was brought forward. You go fast forward to the 16th Street bombing in Birmingham, where four little girls were killed and many people believe deliberately targeted. And the similarity in so many of these cases, Mark, is that the people that were alleged to have done the crimes were initially acquitted by, in the main, all white juries. And allowed essentially to go free. And in many instances, certainly in the case of Medgar Evers and others, it took decades before people were actually brought to justice.
And it's interesting, some of the, you know, first of all, not only did this galvanize the civil rights movement, but it galvanized, you know, just, you know, not too long ago, our guest Keith Beauchamp to make this film.
Yes.
Because he realized there were some loose ends, there were some people still around that knew about this, and there were some people that were involved with it that were still guilty. He made the film, The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till, and that has now reopened the case. They are exhuming the body of Emmett Lewis Till to see if they can find out any new facts about this and bring the people that are still alive and partially responsible for this to justice. And you got to realize, too, that a lot of the structure of what was once in the Old South, that a lot of what happened down there on a racial level, some of those people still are hidden and exist in ideological manner in some elements of the Christian right in this country. That there's a legacy of people in the Christian right, some of them in this country, that believe that pre-Civil War America was a Christian paradise.
Yeah.
And you got to remember that these guys are not gone. It's 16 past the hour. We will be talking to Keith Beauchamp after this about Emmett Till. Please stay with us.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Free, even the phone call is free. Call 877-757-2668. That's 877-757-2668. Call right now.
Going on past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. And we are about to talk to the documentary filmmaker Keith Beauchamp about his film, The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till, whose body is being exhumed, and they are reopening the case. This is a racially motivated, horrific killing that took place in 1955 of a 14-year-old boy. The killers never were brought to justice. They were actually let off the hook. They died of cancer, you know, in 1980.
Yeah.
And the only reason, the only sort of, if there was any justice, was that after one of them, actually went on the record in Look magazine in the 50s and said he did this, that the black community boycotted their stores and put them out of business. Outside of that, there was not any real sense of justice, and because of our guest, there may be that. Good morning, Keith Beauchamp. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing, Keith?
I'm doing fine.
Thank you for being with us. You must feel pretty good today about what you've manifested.
Well, it's amazing. It's still surreal to me what I've been through for the past 9 years while working on this case and trying to get this information out. And, it was a promise that I had to do. I mean, I gave Mrs. Mobley, Emmett's mother, a promise that I would do everything in my power to get this case reopened, and it's happening. So it's something that we both planned to happen. It's just so surreal to me being so young and being involved with this case and thinking, trying to find your identity and your place in society, not knowing that you have a voice of your own. And that it's a great learning experience for me.
Keith Beauchamp, what was it that first drew you to the Emmett Till case?
Well, I was first introduced to the Emmett Till at the age of 10. I was in my parents' study, and I came across a Jet magazine photograph of his corpse, and it shocked me tremendously. And I often, heard his name in my household. I mean, it was a common name that my parents would often tell me to teach me about the racism that still lurks in the Deep South. When I was in high school, I was interracially dating. The first thing my parents would often tell me was, Keith, don't let what happened to Emmett Till happen to you. They didn't say it to stop me from interracially dating. They just wanted me to be aware of my surroundings. When I got into high school, 2 weeks before my high school graduation, I was actually beat up by an undercover police officer for dancing with a white girl.
Where'd you grow up?
In Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Wow. So, I imagine the weight of your parents saying something like that, given that particular region of this country, must have been pretty horrifying.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you heard stories for so many years growing up. If you grew up in the Deep South, this was a story that was told to many African-American males across this country to teach us about the racism that still exists. I mean, it's this story is also a part of the black male psyche. It's
right.
A part of our being. So a lot of us was already educated about the case.
You know,
my parents just often told me over and over again because of what I was doing, interracially dating and things of that nature. And it wasn't until I experienced that myself that I really spurred into the position to try to do something about this case. I moved to New York in 1996 and began writing, directing music videos. And from that, I eventually decided to work on my first feature. And the first thing I ever thought about was doing the story of Emmett Till.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it started. I was doing research to produce a feature film, not doing a documentary. And got into Mississippi and started finding all these eyewitnesses who never spoke out publicly before and realized I wasn't taking interviews anymore. It was depositions.
Keith Beauchamp, one of the more provocative notions that comes out of your research is that there were some black people. involved in the conspiracy to kill Emmett Till. Talk about that.
Absolutely. Through my research, I identified up to 14 people who was involved with the kidnapping and murder of Emmett Lewis Till. Five of these people are black. They were employees to J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant. And we believe that they were forced to participate. This is not new information. I mean, you had many people who uncovered this back in 1955, specifically the NAACP officials, Mega Evers, Ruby Hurley, Amzi Moore, Dr. T.R.M. Howard, as well as black press, Simeon Booker, James Hicks of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, Moses Newsom. They were behind the scenes during the trial trying to find these other eyewitnesses and other people who were involved with the murder. They were the first to come up and say that black men were involved, and not just black men, that other white men was involved as well. I just researched their materials and went to the people that they wasn't able to go to back in 1955 and was surprised to find out that these people were still alive.
Now, did you get a chance to talk to any of these black people? What did they say to you if you did talk to them?
Well, one of them I interviewed for my film, and he denied everything within my film, but because of my research with the FBI records and the Sovereignty Commission records, I was able to find out a little bit more than just what he was saying to us. I know that the FBI has interviewed him, and I believe he came out and told the truth.
So, Keith Bouchamp, the documentary film is The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till.
Yes.
There's some other questions that we'd like to get into after our break. Can you stay with us?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to know a little bit about what we can expect to happen in this trial and some more about some of the people you talk to. So we'll be back with you in just a few minutes.
This is Air America Radio.
Listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
James Galbraith, the journalist and very prestigious economist, might also be on the show. That's tonight on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi,
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. On the phone, we are talking to Keith Bouchamp, the maker of the documentary film "The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till," which actually was a major part in them reopening the case. The body of Emmett Till is to be exhumed and reexamined, and a lot of that has to do with this film. Now, Keith, what can we expect to happen now?
Well, the most important thing is to understand the reasons for exhuming the body. Emmett Till's body was autopsy was never performed on the body in 1955. And with any criminal investigation or criminal case that could possibly go back into court, you're going to need those records. Even if you go back and look at the Meg Evers case that was reopened,
mm-hmm.
and they had to go back and exhume his body.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why they had to do that because they lost the autopsy report. So with any criminal investigation, any criminal case that could possibly go back to trial, this will be used as evidence for the jury. They have to review it. And also, what's been hovering over this case for so many years was that the prosecution could not prove that the body was, in fact, Emmett Till.
Yes.
We know it was Emmett Till, but that's what's been hovering over the case for so long. So we want to lay everything to rest once and for all to show that it's, in fact, Emmett Till, as well as we believe that there's forensic evidence that is there that could link others who were involved with the murder.
Now, Keith, there has been an urban legend for some time that Emmett Till was not actually whistling at this white woman, that he had a speech impediment that caused his voice to sound like a whistle. Did you ever come across that legend during your research?
Absolutely. I worked with Mrs. Mobley, his mother, for 7.5-8 years until she unfortunately passed away in 2003. That was her belief, but I interviewed the witnesses who were there. Emmett Till did whistle, and she was able to find that out before her passing. and deal with it at that time. But yes, Emmett Till did whistle. That's why everything started.
Wow. You know, I really appreciate your work, Keith, and I appreciate you being with us. Am I correct in understanding that commemorating the 50th anniversary of the murder in August, they will be showing the film for a week over at the Film Forum?
Yes, from August 17th to the 30th, they're screening the film to commemorate Emmett's anniversary. This year is the 50th anniversary, so I would like all the New Yorkers to come out in support of this. I mean, Emmett Till was the catalyst that sparked the American Civil Rights Movement, and it's important that my generation get involved and be a part.
Okay, well, we'll have you back on.
Definitely.
And we'll plug it as that date approaches. Thanks for being with us, Keith.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Keith.
Wow. You know, and it's like this stuff, the tension that causes this kind of horrible murder. I mean, it's still obviously very present. We saw a film a few weeks ago, a screening of Paul Haggis' film, who we're going to talk to in a few minutes here, that is almost completely fueled by racial tension on so many different levels.
On many different levels, and not just racial tensions, but class tensions within races as well.
Yeah, I think we've got the trailer for that here.
What did you want me to do? Get us both shot?
I just had a gun pointed in my face. And it was my fault because I knew it was going to happen.
Heads in plain sight, step out of the vehicle.
Honey, stay inside.
Man, don't walk up on me.
I know this man.
Get back.
It's a hell of a cast.
Yeah, it is.
Sandra Bullock, Brendan Fraser,
Ludacris.
Ryan Phillippe, Ludacris, Matt Dillon.
That
was insane.
Yeah.
And we're joined now by the writer and director of Crash, Paul Haggis. He also wrote the screenplay for this year's Best Picture Oscar winner, Million Dollar Baby, for which he received an Oscar nomination. Crash opens nationwide tomorrow. You and I love the film. And,
absolutely.
And I'm thrilled that you're here. Paul Haggis, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot for being here.
What an amazing movie this Crash is.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
We'll talk about Million Dollar Baby later, but I want to talk about Crash because I tell you, I saw coming attractions for it, and when I see coming attractions of a film that, you know, where you have all these different stories that are somehow, you know, synchronicity and serendipitously connected, my first response is, how are they going to pull that off? But your film actually does it because the topic and the subject and the themes of the film are so powerful and so intense that you don't even think, it doesn't even make a difference.
Oh, thanks.
That there is this connection. The connection's important, but you know what I'm saying?
Well, it's good that it doesn't make a difference because we had no idea what we were doing. You sort of started at the beginning and somehow got through it.
But so. I thought you deal with, white on black racism, black on white racism, white on Asian, white on Asian on white, Asian on Mexican. You deal with
black
every,
on black, everything.
Every
yeah,
type
everything,
of racism
yeah.
possible.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you watch a film that deals with things like this, they kind of leave you hanging. But you, because the character is so well thought out, the evolution of the story, it makes perfect sense and it doesn't leave you hanging. What inspired the film?
You know, a lot of things didn't. I didn't want to do a polemic. I didn't want to do some great, fabulous piece about race or about intolerance or any of these things. I just started thinking about these two kids who jacked my car back about 15 years ago, and I couldn't get them out of my mind. And I just over time kept thinking about who they were and you know, if they thought they were criminals and if they'd been best friends for, and if so, how long. And I just thought about these kids. And then I woke up 2 o'clock in the morning one day and just had to write about them. And waking up in the morning with an idea or 2 o'clock in the morning is a terrible thing because if you get up and you write it down, you're not going to go back to sleep for hours. And you'll get up in the morning and look at it and it'll just be crap.
Yeah, what did I mean? What are you talking about here?
And if you don't write it down, you'll know in the morning it was the best idea ever. And you've forgotten it. You know? So I woke up, I started writing it down, and by 10 o'clock, I asked myself, well, what happened to people that bumped into? What happened to people that those people bumped into? I just kept following these people around and seeing how strangers affected strangers, and by 10 o'clock in the morning, I had an outline. I called my friend Bobby, we wrote the thing.
The one thing that made me wonder in this film, because the film generates its own momentum, it kind of moves very quickly, but then you stop it at points to develop whole scenes. For example, when Michael Pena, who plays this Latino burglar alarm and locksmith guy, goes under the bed to talk to his daughter, who's scared because she's been afraid of gunshots.
Yeah.
How did you decide when to slow it down like that?
You know, it was just by feel. You're just going through and you go, and you have to be fearless with those things. So you're writing away and you get to a 7-page scene, which is going to go on forever and people in all the screenwriting books and people say, oh, you can't do that. And they go, no, I think I can. You just do it.
Now, you obviously have no problem with making audiences uncomfortable.
Yeah, I like that.
Now, but see, now, Hollywood doesn't always like that. Did the suits give you any trouble about comfort level?
Well, see, I was really lucky in dealing with this one and with Million Dollar Baby because I just didn't know what I was doing. I came out of television, and I wrote these two screenplays, this one with Bobby Moresco, and we did it on spec. We weren't paid. No one paid for us to do these. Or
neither
Dollar
of them?
Baby. Neither, no. Uh-huh. Million Dollar Baby, I put my own money up to option that book and chased it and held on to it for 4 years, got Hillary and got Morgan, and we finally got Clint after 4 years to do it. And then he just shot my first draft. It was great. This one, we wrote on spec, and just no one was going to pay us. We were TV writers. No one was going to say, oh, we should get the guy who did Facts of Life to come in and do the next Clint Eastwood movie. It's just not going to happen. So we wrote them on spec and then did our best. And that way, so you don't have people telling you what to do because no one's around. You know, it's my wife. That's it.
So that's interesting. So Facts of Life is really where you learned about the dark turmoil.
Yeah, exactly. You know, those tootie scenes. Sometimes those, you know, there's getting conflict with Blair or whatever. Yeah, that did it for me.
Now, what about the performers? Because you had quite a cast. You had Don Cheadle. You had Matt Dillon. You had Sandra Bullock. You had Brendan Fraser.
Tandy Newton.
Was there anyone that was there any discomfort on the set? Were there people that had difficulty playing things or saying some of the language that you were putting in their mouth?
Oh yeah, I mean I had difficulty writing it, and then you give it to these actors and they all want a challenge, but then you have to do the scene. Like Matt Dillon, he has a scene to do with Tandy Newton and Terrence Howard, and that first scene. And when you watch it, you go, oh, it's chilling. And afterwards, he was fine. You know, you get in uniform, you do the scene, and he really loved it. And afterwards, he'd sit down and he'd just be ashen-faced.
All right, well, look, when we come back, we're going to talk to Paul Haggis about how some of his actors felt about playing racist, and we'll talk about Million Dollar Baby and what's Paul's reaction to the controversy all that created. So stay with us. It's 43 past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Help support our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Operation Truth. We were there.
Paid for by Operation Truth, Incorporated.
Forty-seven past the hour. Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're talking with Paul Haggis. He's the writer-director of the new movie Crash, which opens tomorrow. And the movie deals pretty frankly, you know, with race. So here's a frank question: do you think everybody's a little racist?
Well, you know, this is a movie about intolerance more than racism. You know, I think this is a movie about how we react to strangers and anybody who looks different from us. So that could be the guy with the big nose or
anyone who's different.
Or the person who lives next door. We're all, I think more with everything that's going on since 9/11. We're just scared. You know, and so yes, I think we all have fear within us.
The trick to being to humanity is to overcome the fear and learn how to accept.
Yeah, and be scared in the right places.
Right.
Sometimes it's right to be scared. You know?
I love some of the observations in the film about Los Angeles.
Yeah.
In relation to, because I've lived in both places.
I'm not kind to L.A.
But you're right on the money, because I say that a lot, that, you know, in New York, like, you're never, there's always someone right here, and you don't think twice about it, and it actually adds to the humanity of the place.
Yeah.
I think this is the most tolerant, most polite, most accepting city in the world. And in L.A., you know, if you see somebody who's walking on the sidewalk, you're like, oh, what's wrong with that guy?
Oh, yeah, immediately suspicious. Anybody who walks period, any color.
Yeah,
you know, exactly.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. And in this case, a lot of the characters are just unapologetic. Sandra Bullock, the stuff that she does, she just, and what made her so great in this, just terrific role. It was a very dramatic role. She's just unapologetic. And
it was great seeing her as a bitch, for real.
She just really just step up and she just get great work.
Yeah, there was a couple of moments there where, you know, just you know, her anger and her frustration. I was just very relieved to see her out of that sort of glib kind of.
She really wanted to do this. She stepped up and really wanted to do this work. And people said, what a great performance you got out of her. I did nothing. I turned the camera on. She walked in and did terrific work.
I wonder if there are some people that, like, you know, found. Did you find that any of the people, you know, like you said, Matt Dillon kind of crumpled after his character took him down that dark place? Were any characters or any of the actors sort of relieved and excited to get that kind of anger out of them?
Yeah, very much so. Terrence Howard, you know, it was amazing how you know, life continued to copy art all the way through, because you'd cast someone like Terrence Howard, and you go, you know, She says, this is my story, Terrence said. And he'd tell me how this exact story happened to him at some point where the cops came with guns. And he was just in a big misunderstanding, and he almost got shot, and that was that. And he just wouldn't back down. Other times we had this story about this locksmith, Hispanic locksmith, who has gang tattoos. And, mm-hmm. And so this woman wants these locks changed again in the morning, doesn't trust him. And so it's a low-budget film, so we're trying to get stuff free, and we call up a locksmith company to try and get their truck, and they say, okay, you can have it. What's the storyline? And we tell them, and they said, oh, yeah, that happens all the time.
Wow.
Just these sort of things, if you write them, if you can think them, they usually happen.
That's unbelievable. And, I really want to, congratulate you on transcending the notion of connecting everybody. Because it was really effective.
Oh, thank you. Well, you just wanted a good drama. That's what you want. You didn't want to do this bump out there speechifying. And you want to be able to connect these people and to have fun and to really let something pay off.
Yeah. Now, let's shift to a movie that we can now talk openly about, can we? Paul wrote Million Dollar Baby. Mm-hmm. Did you have any anticipation that you would get flack for being pro-euthanasia?
No, none at all. I mean, it was kind of weird because, stunned about this because it's a story. These are individual characters you're dealing with, and you put this up. And in this case, you want to dramatically stack the stakes really high against this woman's asking for him to do this thing. And so I say, well, what's the hardest thing for this man to do? Well, this would be this. Why is that hard? Well, he's a Catholic. He's a daily communicant. He believes if he does this, he'll lose his soul. And then he does what he does, and he loses his soul. Those stakes are pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't think this guy's going to go, oh yeah, should kill somebody? Oh, okay. Why not? No, you want to, as a writer, as a dramatist, you want to make things hard. So I thought we stacked it pretty well on each side, but others.
It seemed like from the public reaction, Clint Eastwood was completely taken aback. I mean,
he was.
Not to say he's a complete right wing guy, but he was certainly a Republican. He was certainly a very prominent public Republican.
Yeah.
And the kind of attacks he got seemed to genuinely stun him. Did it?
Yeah, it did. Absolutely, he was very surprised. He just they can be incredibly stupid people, and no matter what they believe politically, and we know there's a bunch of stupid ones on the right. So and we got our share on the left too.
Yeah,
so,
true.
So he was very surprised that people would view this as a documentary, a pro euthanasia documentary, because it just wasn't.
Well, they're not even people. They're people, but they're religious fanatics.
Yeah,
I mean they're not. It was coming from a place of clarity, and somebody directed them.
Yeah.
To have this reaction to the film because they just wanted to make something. They love being able to say that it's Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's anti-Christian. They're pro-death. These people. It's like,
yeah.
How did you miss the point?
I know. Anti-Christian. I had the guy going to church every single day.
Yeah.
Who talks to his priest every single day, and then who believes? Who really believes? And you don't make fun of him. This man believes. I'm Catholic. I believe. So he's this guy was too.
And that's all, and also in both films, A Million Dollar Baby and in Crash, is that the characters did not, as we talked a little bit about before, they didn't have to declare themselves. They were so well written that you saw those conflicts and those struggles, and even in some characters where they actually came from, like the Matt Dillon character, where he, but when he was talking to that woman,
Shaniqua.
Loretta Devine.
Yeah.
She's great.
He was explaining himself, and he knew himself.
Yeah.
And he was explaining his situation, but you saw the core.
Well, you want to do that. When you're writing characters, when you're directing characters, and certainly when they're acting, you want these characters to be right. We're all right in our own opinions. You sit there, and you want to convince the audience. The person goes on and says, and takes this ridiculous position, whatever it is, and by the end, you should go, oh, yeah, that's right. And you go, oh, what did I disagree with?
Yeah.
And then you twist around the other way. You hear the other person go, yeah, well, that's perfectly right.
Yeah.
You want to do. And then you want to keep surprising them. That's what I try to do. And with Million Dollar Baby, just want to keep people on their toes.
Oh, you certainly surprised me in both films, and it was great having you with us, Paul Haggis. The new film is Crash. It will be out May 6th. It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much. And people, go see this one.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you. And Paul's got to run out of here. I want to keep people up to date here real quick. Two grenades did explode a couple of blocks from here, Riley.
Yes.
And, I guess everything's cool. There was no structural damage. I don't know where they came from. It was in front of the British Consulate. But I'll tell you, coming to work in the morning,
When you see the sirens, you see the you're in New York City. It's the middle of the night. I'm driving down the street. There's nobody on the road on Second Avenue. I see sirens and fire trucks blocked off streets. I'm like, maybe we should go back home.
but you know what? Yeah. That kind of thing is a cottage industry in this town. There are people who have police radios sitting by their bedsides. And when those police, that's how reporters find out about these things before everybody else does. They hear these policemen, they're deploying a huge number of cops to a certain area. They know that that's a place where people need to go. Now, they have not yet caught whoever planted those bombs.
Well,
those people are still on loose. We don't know. It could have been a disgruntled employee of one of the dozens of companies that are in the same building as the British Consul. We don't know it's tied to the British elections.
Could have been political. It's hard to tell. Brendan P.W. McDonald was just getting here into work. He said he didn't hear nothing. So, we're going to go along with our day, but we'll try to keep abreast of what's going on there. I'm going to be in Cincinnati tomorrow doing the show from there. I got two shows at Go Bananas, if you're listening to 1530 WCKY, The Revolution and Talk Radio. Come on down and see me if you're in the area. I'm looking forward to I've never been to Cincinnati, Mark.
You've never been?
I have not. Have you?
No.
So when we come back, also, we got Lou Dobbs, who we've got to ask some questions of, because we have this weird relation with Lou. We come into work, he's on TV on the repeat of the Lou Dobbs show. We usually have him with no sound and just assume he's freaking out.
Bashing Mexicans again.
About Mexicans taking his job. I wonder if Lou's frightened that Mexicans are going to take his job.
I don't know. Vicente Fox may be looking for one soon if the election goes in particular.
Maybe that's what he's really afraid of. We'll talk to him about that and also just about immigration in general and the issue of outsourcing, which is really his thing. That's what he talks about. We're also going to talk about Ann Coulter, who did a speaking engagement, and somebody heckled her, and we have to figure out, I'm not sure how we can even talk about it as a news story, because
we'll find a way.
He asked a question about a particular sexual practice that we're gonna have to feel our way around this.
Thou shalt not kill.
Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ass. That's a Fug song. For some reason, we're playing it. Someone sent us this Fug CD, and that's in our head. Terrific.
Yeah.
So we'll be back with that. Lou Dobbs, Ann Coulter, and how to talk about that. Yeah.
After this, it's Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. It's morning's edition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you out there in the dark, secretly shamed, craving the truth? I will be in Cincinnati, Ohio tomorrow morning. I will be broadcasting from there with Mark Riley. I'll be at Go Bananas in Cincinnati tomorrow night and Saturday night. If you're listening to 1530 WCKY, come on down. You can go to morningsedition.com for ticket info. Also, want to report that we had Judd Legum here on the show last week from the Center for American Progress. www.dropthehammer.org has achieved some results.
Yeah.
They rallied to get Verizon, American Airlines, Nissan North America to give to stop giving money to Tom DeLay's legal defense fund, which they all had done collectively, altogether put in about $15,000 since the year 2000. They've all said they will not do it anymore. Political action actually having a result.
Yeah.
How do you like that? What else have we got? We've got two grenades that exploded around the corner from here, apparently about 4 in the morning. I didn't hear anything. PW didn't hear anything. Dan Pashman, of course, overslept today.
I don't know what that was about.
Claims that the power went out over his place.
Yeah.
Overslept. That had nothing to do with the fact that there's a softball game tonight, and he might want to be more alert and aware so he can make the team better.
Coincidence or conspiracy?
Yes, I think not. But anyways, apparently no one was hurt. There was some damaged windows. They don't know where they came from, what's going on. We'll try to keep on top of that in the time we have left here on the show.
Oh, by the way, you know, yes. We got and I just want to mention this very quickly in passing. Mm-hmm. This guy, Larry Franklin, man, this is going to blow up to be a heck of a case. The guy has been charged with apparently distributing information illegally. He worked in that Office of Special Plans. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Douglas Feist, little
mm-hmm.
Feistum down there in
mm-hmm.
the Pentagon?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently this guy's been passing secrets to an Israeli lobbying group.
Wow, so we got
allegedly.
Got to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily we have, of course, this iNews 5000 that we use to translate the headlines. So let's crank this baby up and feed it some headlines. From ABC Online, Blair expected to be returned for third term. Blair expected to be returned for third term. Translation here, England shrugs, votes, goes to pub. Wait a minute. There's another translation. Prospect of third term gives Bush horrifying idea. Uh-oh. All right, from Fox News, Iraq reconstruction funds missing. Iraq reconstruction funds missing. Translation, Iraq funds got cold feet about upcoming wedding and fled. Mm. Whoa, boy, this seems weird today.
Yeah.
Here's another translation. Surprise influx of cash funds new community center in Cayman Islands. More likely.
Yeah.
From ABC News, Bush celebrates Cinco de Mayo a day early. Bush celebrates Cinco de Mayo a day early. Translation, Bush blames Gonzalez for intelligence failure. Hey, what the hell is wrong with the machine? Wait, embarrassed Bush gives back Texas. So now we've got to do this story, Riley.
Yeah, we
Coulter,
do.
The horror, the evil succubus pundit for the other side, was at the University of Texas at Austin.
Why?
Doing one of her sticks for about $30,000 a pop she gets to spew that crap out of her hole. Now what I'm saying. So now a guy stands up. All right, a guy stands up, a student, this fellow Ajay Raj, an English sophomore, all right, in the middle of this. Now, this guy gets busted, all right? Now, first of all, he gets busted for heckling. He gets busted for saying something. And apparently the police charged the guy with disorderly conduct, good timing, and a nice smart-alecky delivery. But what he said, you know, the problem was, is that he basically, Ann Coulter was talking about how she felt about gay marriage.
Yes.
And she said exactly, she said, Where is what she said?
She supports the definition of marriage as between a man and a woman, and that a good woman civilizes and inspires a man to strive for something better, leading to a question that was met with stunned silence.
Yes, yes. This guy, this Ajay Raj, stood up and says, how do you feel about a marriage where the man does nothing but... So what are we going to do with that?
Yeah, really.
You know, how are we even going to begin to talk about it? I mean, what can you say in place of that? What can you say? I mean, what, explore his wife's posterior in a roughshod fashion? Can we say that? You got any ideas? How do we tell the story?
I don't know. Perhaps we could call it a short pass to the tight end.
Oh, I got one. What do you got? How about blocking her fire exit?
No.
Oh, no. Kill her buster?
There you go. Wait. How about Tucker his wife in the rear with his Carlson?
Oh, no,
fashion.
Uh-oh. We're done now.
Yes. I got one. How about tamp her pants camper?
Oh, no.
I got another one, actually. Come home by the back stairs.
No. How about a little political action? Lobby her rotunda.
Hello.
Do we got anything there?
I got a having an end zone celebration.
How about give her pundit a stern rebuttal? But so what happens is, do we got any more? Because this is really going places.
Yeah, it is.
So what happens, they arrest this kid. Now, the problem that I have with this is that she is a provocateur. She does put people into the position where she obviously knows when she goes out to one of these gigs that people are going to boo her. Like, where are you going, Passion? What, are you afraid? Well, Rested, you got softball on your mind? You can hang out.
Come on, man.
Sit down. All right.
Come on. Larson's out of town.
That's a good times roll.
Yeah, right? You better get a hit tonight, pal.
Boy, this show is going in the crap.
No, it's going in the rotunda.
Yeah. Exactly. This show's going for the three-pointer. Hello, Chico.
Yeah, I'll fill your buster.
But
anyway.
Don't you think, wait, now, she knows she's going to get this stuff, and she knows that this guy's going to stand up. I think this guy had not only every right to do it, but he should do it. You should be crass. You should be angry. You should put her on the spot, be sexually provocative, do whatever you have to do to get your point across against these idiots. And they can't make us, look stupid for doing this. It was a reasonable question. She is, a fraud. She's a clown. She knows that it's just an act, and she should... If there is a hell, which I don't think there is, they're definitely going to have a place, not for her being evil, just for her being a lying, disingenuous bitch. I mean, the truth of the matter is that I think it's just an act, so people should be able to participate. She should be. Why does she have heckler lines? Why does she got to be a baby? It's like, I'm not going to go on until they remove that guy. Shut up. You're a comedian. Get some lines.
Exactly. It is so hypocritical for her, of all people, to take the high road.
Right.
Wait a minute. She's making 30 long. She ought to have had, patience for 25 hecklers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Take the check. What's the problem?
I'm just happy she's making that low of money, because I know Jon Stewart makes much more than that. Franken makes more than that. That's beautiful. You know what I mean? Franken's got to make a lot more than that. He's got to make a lot more than that. Oh, she's like low.
But she's such a publicity skank.
Yeah.
That's why she doesn't charge that much. She'll go wherever they'll take her. I mean, yeah. She'll do a performance in your bathroom if you give her $30,000.
Yeah, but you know what? She'll get 5 more gigs out of this.
See what happens when you hate your father?
Oh.
See what happens when you don't get the attention you want, or the wrong kind of attention? You become an evil succubus, pundit from, she's just awful.
And never skinny enough.
Yeah, really. So that's I don't even want to go into psychoanalyzing that part of her personality, but I do know that she's a clown, and she knows exactly what she's doing, and she should get some lines as opposed to say, oh, get the man out that's saying the awful thing.
Right.
Get him out. Get the man out who asked, what if the people just want to be married and spoon quickly? Wrong?
Well, it's over when Matt Drudge describes you as a controversialist. What the hell is that?
It's nothing. It's a comic. It's a clown. She's a clown. She's an anorexic clown.
She should go on a road with Mr. T then, maybe.
Something that actually would be a good tour.
I would actually go to see that.
Yeah, I would too. We're going to be back. We got Lou Dobbs coming up, and we're taking the show to a whole new level. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Congressman Gerald Nadler from New York's 8th District, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
Our state variation. Call American Life, 1-866-492-2500. That's 1-866-492-2500.
Twenty past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
I'm Mark Maron. Tomorrow I will be in Cincinnati. Friday and Saturday night, go bananas. If you're listening to WCKY 1530, the Revolution of Talk Radio, I'll also be broadcasting from Cincinnati this morning. Well, folks, since our president is operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily. Oh, yeah. We have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone once again is Planet Bush Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. This show has gotten so filthy.
No, stop
since
it.
Larson's been gone. We all just have no rules, apparently. And don't call Ann Coulter a succubus.
No.
She is a good friend of mine.
Oh,
be nice.
God. Oh.
You give her a chance, she'll give you one.
Oh, come on. She's horrible.
Horrible. She's not a succubus.
Horrible.
That's fighting words.
Oh, you know what, Lawton? Let me tell you something. I'm going to read you something here that Pat Robertson said. All right?
Pat Robertson.
Yes,
amen,
yes.
Amen, amen. You're taking those baby steps toward the Lord.
No,
testify,
look.
Brother Mark.
All right, look. Stop it.
Testify.
Listen to what Pat Robertson said on ABC about Muslims serving as judges. Quote, they have said in the Quran there's a war against all the infidels.
Yep.
Do you want somebody like that sitting as a judge? I wouldn't, end quote. Now, what kind of person would say something like that?
the kind of person who walks right up to the truth and says, hi, I'm Pat Robertson. Nice to meet you. Let's chat for
Wait a minute. The truth, the man's a bigot. He's a bully. He's a pig. Can't stand him.
Sticks and stones, Mark.
Right.
Come on. Let's look this thing in the eye. How are we supposed to create a sturch with Muslims on the courts?
Wow.
State, church, sturch. Learn the word.
Oh, come on.
Learn
come on. I will never
sturch.
Use that word. And Muslims
sturch.
Already serve.
Sturch.
They already serve. You got me saying sturve. They already serve on many levels
sturch,
of the government,
yeah.
My friend, including judges at a state and local level.
Well, you know, maybe in the secular hellhole you live in, but not on planet Bush. I see a Muslim wearing a black robe sneaking around my gated community. I'll call Homeland Security. Go
right,
on.
Come on.
Go
come
on, you. Get out of my search.
Why can't a Muslim be a judge? Huh? Tell me that.
They don't understand the way we do things over here. No. American values, culture of life.
Mm-hmm.
You really think a Muslim judge is going to show pity on a poor, persecuted fella like Ken Lay?
Oh, stop it.
That
come
judge
on.
Would probably have his knuckles chopped off and made into couscous. They do that. I saw a special on that.
What are you talking about over here? They're already here, Lawton. They're Americans. They pay taxes. They're just like you, only smarter.
Well, okay. I'm going to do what they taught me at Bob Jones University and ignore the sarcasm. And, Mark, Muslims are not just like us. Look at their culture. Men holding hands, facial hair. And it's not like they're even interested in Jesus.
Oh, that's,
like they don't care.
That's a great point there, Watt.
A practical level,
yeah.
If I have to go to traffic court because I have, say, I don't know, 8 or 9 speeding tickets, I certainly don't want to have to explain myself to Judge Akbar, who already thinks I'm guilty because I'm an infidel.
Oh, man.
No, sir. Keep your jihad out of my church.
You know what? You guys are always bitching that there's some kind of war on people of faith, and then you turn around and you attack one entire group of people of faith.
Well, Mark, there's faith, and then there's faith.
Oh, come on.
Now, without Jesus, all those Muslims might as well be praying to a toaster.
Oh, stop.
Okay?
That's
those
ridiculous.
Fellas are near the bottom of God's to-do
list.
Oh,
come on. Listen to me. Here's
near
what
the bottom.
No, stop it. Here's what a spokesman from the Council on American Islamic Relations says. Quote, this type of hate-filled rhetoric deserves repudiation from all who respect America's longstanding tradition of pluralism. End quote. That's what Pat Robertson is. Full of hate, full of phony rhetoric, anti-Christian, anti-American, and the fact that you let this blowhard drag your party into one hateful mess after another one is going to bring you down. It's going to bring you down, buddy.
You're wrong.
Oh, my God.
My neighbor's a Muslim.
There you go.
Tariq's the best guy in the world.
See that?
And you're right. He is a lot smarter than I am. And even though he finds me 3 or 4 times a week nude and shivering behind the Walmart, the judges.
Oh, no.
Tariq just covers me with newspaper and takes me home.
Oh, boy.
Why does Pat Robertson hate Tariq?
It's a little too much information. All right, okay, all right, buddy. Take it easy. Take it easy, buddy. Take it easy.
All over me a lot of times.
Everyone's got hobbies. Just take it easy.
I'm not a succubus.
I know. I know. Take it easy. Please, pull it together. All right. There you go. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, Pat Robertson's going to be Pope with the new sturch.
Oh.
We're going to build him a Vatican. City of gold. No Muslim judges.
Yeah.
Ann Coulter will be there.
Goodbye.
You can visit her.
Goodbye.
Not a succubus. I'm going to tell her.
Goodbye.
Tell her.
God
loves you.
Oh.
Do it.
No, they're going to build him a Vatican.
Lord,
yeah,
we should have sang our song for him. Thou shalt not kill.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was already going to the good part.
Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ass.
All right. So that's the Fugs. We're actually seeing the Fugs in 2005 here. So we're going to have Lou Dobbs in a minute. So can we talk a little bit about immigration?
Absolutely.
I need to know some things because my innate instinct is that, first of all, I grew up in New Mexico. And I wasn't in a border town or anything like that. But he seems to have a specific problem with Mexican immigrants. And there's a lot of issues here because we have a lot of progressives, a lot of liberals who do say that immigration should be regulated somehow. It should be, you know, this should be enforced because they believe that Americans are losing jobs to people who are coming over here illegally and taking jobs for very low money, for no health coverage, and they're pushing Americans out of these jobs. I don't know. I guess that is true in some areas. I mean, there is also a question of what jobs are there here. Manufacturing has left this country in a lot of ways, and Lou Dobbs talks about outsourcing. But I think he's got a problem with Mexicans.
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll find out if he's got a problem with Mexicans. But the bottom line here is that this is nothing new. If you look at previous waves of immigrants coming to this country, there's always been an issue about whether or not they're taking jobs from, quote, legitimate Americans. This is going back. Go back to the turn of the 20th century. You heard some of the same arguments. Immigrants were all communists. They were anarchists. And now, of course, there's a question of whether or not people are inadvertently allowing terrorists into the country. That adds a separate layer to this whole thing.
And I come from immigrants. I mean, my great.
Me too, although mine didn't come voluntarily.
Yeah. My great grandparents were immigrants. And, you know, there's some part of me that says that second generation, third generation, a lot of these immigrants are here to make a better life for themselves and to be part of this country.
Well, we'll get Lou Dobbs' opinion on all this and see if he's as big a xenophobe as maybe some people think.
I'm a little nervous.
Relax. It's Lou Dobbs when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Personal freedoms. It is America.
Jerry Springer on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Word.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. You know, I tell you, I'm looking forward to going to Cincinnati. I've never been to Cincinnati. Have you been to Cincinnati?
You must be the only person in New York who's looking forward to going to
well,
Cincinnati.
I mean, you know, I've never been there. There's a lot of places I haven't been. I don't think I've even been to Cleveland.
I've been to Cleveland.
Yeah, I think I've driven through Ohio, I don't know if I have even.
Really?
I mean, why would I drive through Ohio?
Well, it's a nice corner.
There's Dayton. I don't know about
Akron, the rubber.
Well, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there this weekend.
Toledo, home of the Mud Hens.
Yeah, the Mud Hens.
What the is Mud that? Hens. I'm That's sorry. The name of their AAA baseball team.
Oh, of course, the Mud Hens. Sure. I'm excited to talk to our guest. We watch him. We have sort of a weird relationship with Lou Dobbs because he's, you know, when we come in.
He's on when we're in.
And we, you know, and we have the sound off, and we enjoy pretending like we know what Lou is saying with the sound off. And he's got a book coming out. It's called Exporting America. You know him from CNN. He's a very polarizing character. We just from people knowing he's coming on, we've got two posts. There's a blog post that said Dobbs is so obscene. If he really cared about illegal immigration, why not show pictures of the people that hire illegal immigrants instead of the same old stock footage of Mexicans running? If he cared about outsourcing, why not show pictures of the CEOs that chose to outsource instead of the stock footage of Indian call center workers or Chinese factories? Then we got an email that says, please don't mischaracterize Lou Dobbs as a racist. He is pro-legal immigrant. He sparked me back to life following politics. I have a huge amount of respect for him. Good morning, Lou Dobbs. How are you?
Good morning, Lou.
Good morning. Good to be with you guys.
Now Lou, do you feel that that you might lose your job to an illegal immigrant?
You know, I don't think so.
Okay. Why do you think you're so polarizing? I mean, what is it that you? How would you solve the issue of immigration?
Well, I obviously first I don't think I'm that polarizing. I may be too at the margin.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm polarizing people, it's people who, you know, there's an old saying. You know, denial is not just a river in Egypt.
Sure. I know that saying. Yeah.
People are simply awakening to some very tough realities that really creates some discomfort for their ideology, their partisan politics, because some of the most critical issues facing us are being ignored by both Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, or because of their ideology, they have sort of a twisted perspective, in my opinion.
But most people in this country have come from immigrants. I don't know that, you know, if my great-grandparents were legal or illegal, but, I mean, a lot of these people are coming here because they believe in America.
Hey, don't we all?
Sure.
The fact of the matter is that you all and none of your listeners or anyone on the web or anyone on the planet has ever heard me say anything that is anti-immigrant. I'm pro-immigration. I love this country. I love the fact that we're the most diverse society on the face of the earth. We have so much to be proud of in this country. We're heterogeneous. we're just a remarkable amalgam of talents and backgrounds and experiences. We have so much to be proud of. When people try to boil issues like illegal immigration down to race, you will find usually they are people who are open border advocates, they are pro-illegal immigration, and really have very little concern for the broader good of our society. And to me, that's troubling, and it's unfortunate, it's disappointing, but it's the reality, and we choose to confront that reality.
Now, Lou Dobbs, I will say, in fairness, although I don't agree with all your views, I have seen you in the past and heard you, ironically enough, talk about some of the people that employ illegal immigrants.
Absolutely.
Let's talk for a moment about...
Does the name Walmart come to mind?
Yeah, Walmart. I mean, you have done that work. But in many instances, I think people tend to see, when they see your program, they do see the Mexicans crossing the border. They do see, you know, immigration or illegal immigration, I guess, in very stark terms. But then there are situations in this country, and I'm sure you're aware of this, where politicians make what is, under normal circumstances, illegal immigration into legal immigration, where they create loopholes for certain groups of people to come into the country. And some people argue that rarely, if ever, are those people who are the beneficiaries of those loopholes people of color.
I would say that's probably right. In point of fact, I know it's right. Look at the duplicity, the hypocrisy of our legal immigration policies when it comes to the Caribbean and primarily people of color. Look what's happening in terms of immigration from Africa in particular. The truth is we need to examine this. This is what I'm calling for, Mark. I'm trying to get people to say, let's make publicly conscious public policy decisions and not have it be simply a de facto matter where corporate America makes a decision for 300 million Americans. Let all of us exercise our responsibilities and our rights as in a participatory democracy and demand representation from our Congress, from the Senate, from the House, and from the President.
Now, let me ask you a question, Lou.
Sure.
Isn't it a myth, though, that on some level the idea of immigrants coming and taking jobs away from Americans in terms of some jobs, that I don't believe that is necessarily true. And I believe that on some level that if you were to put that to a vote, that it'd be almost impossible unless people were really well-informed and were really able to get in touch with their opinion that racism would, sort of rear its ugly head.
Yeah, I would just like to hear one example of racism in the issue of illegal immigration. I really have not seen nor heard nor read of an example of racism as it applies to immigration, whether it be open borders illegal immigration or whether it be in terms of Congress itself.
Isn't it kind of racist and manipulative to show, footage of Mexicans crossing a border or Chinese people in a factory, over and over and over again on some level?
You would have to explain to me the level, because if you can't deal with the reality that we have Asians who are illegal immigrants, that we have Europeans who are illegal immigrants, and that 80% of the illegal aliens crossing our southern border, and the most recent estimate last year was 3 million, happen to be Mexican or Central American, I mean, what in the world are you saying?
Do you see this as the biggest...
Are you saying that we should ignore reality? I mean, to me, that's the ultimate in racism. It's the ultimate in paternalism and condescending beyond belief to say, oh, because this person is, quote-unquote, a person of color, we have to ignore the reality that surrounds them and confronts us.
So meet me in the middle. How do we solve the issue? How do we solve the issue? How do we make it so we make our borders, welcome people that are willing to come into our country and to, to work and honor, the principles of what this country is built on? How do we make it right, Lou?
First thing we have to do, because we're 3.5 years, and my concern about this issue arose out of September 11th, the first thing we have to do is understand that Homeland Security, which to me still sounds like something out of the Third Reich, is a real concept that we actually mean and sincerely support. Our borders are wide open. There is just an amazing disconnect in public policy where we would spend $36 billion in so little to secure our border. We have no idea of who's coming across that border. We have no idea who is crossing the Canadian border. We have only inspections of 4% of the goods coming through our ports. And we then have, you know, some sanctimonious bureaucrats stand up and say, well, you know, we're doing a great job on Homeland Security and we're budgeting this for first responders. It's utter nonsense.
Did you support the militia? Because they were a little questionable characters.
Militia?
The militia at the borders in the Minutemen Project that was patrolling the borders of Mexico recently.
Oh, I not only support what they did, they are the Minuteman Project, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I just said it, yeah.
But I went down to Bisbee in Douglas, Arizona to see who they were and what they were about. And I will tell you something. The great lie surrounding that group of people, these people were, for the most part, retired people. They were men. They were women. Honest, God-fearing, decent human beings.
Did some of them have tie to white supremacy?
None that I know of. Mm-hmm. None whatsoever. And who made the charge? And how is that carried around in the media? That these are white supremacists of some sort.
I
think it's fascinating because
I'm just asking you if there was any connection.
Well, none that I know of.
Okay.
Whatsoever.
Now, Lou, let me ask you. You talk about, and I know that you're a persistent critic of outsourcing along with illegal immigration, but there are those who say that better conditions in countries where immigrants come from will cut down on illegal immigration. To some extent, the creation of jobs in places like Mexico and other places, lessen the pressure of Mexicans or people from other places to migrate to the States?
Question, because I mean I love high-minded theory. It goes to what we all, you know, those of us who believe in an aspirational society, a free market democracy, this country believe. But let's look at the facts. I supported NAFTA on a very simple basis in '92 and '93, and that is if this the richest nation in the world is going to enrich anyone, why not enrich our neighbors? So I was fully supportive and enthusiastic about NAFTA. But what have those 12 years taught us in terms of the reality? We've lost 1 million jobs because of NAFTA in this country. The government of Mexico wants to deny the reality that it is still just as corrupt as it was 10 years ago. Labor in Mexico is treated abhorrently. We still do not have side letter agreements on either protection of the Mexican environment or Mexican workers. This is 12 years later, and that was supposed to be a condition precedent of the treaty.
Now, does that mean that you're supporting...
Manufacturing wages in Mexico have declined by 27%.
All true, Lou, but are you...
GDP growth is half what its historical average was.
Does that mean you're supporting López Obrador for president?
I am, by the way, we're probably... I can't say this with absolute certainty. We're probably the only broadcast that reported on every event surrounding López Obrador and his battle against a corrupt government and political party that we thought would be an effective countervailing influence against the PRI.
Now, you also...
So, yes, I do support the man because he's trying to do something for the people of Mexico.
Okay.
But there's a lot of free market thinkers, like people that we've talked to, like, you know, Thomas Friedman. I haven't talked to him, but I've read his work. Yeah,
that's
right.
Not a free market thinker. That's a free market evangelist. They believe in faith-based economics, and Tom Friedman will go native wherever you want him to.
But how do you bring the jobs back here, Lou? I mean, it's like it seems that all the momentum of
Wait. Now you want me to bring the jobs back. You were saying it was a good thing that we send jobs to Mexico or to other countries as a matter of aid.
No. I didn't say that.
No. I was just saying, in theory, if conditions are better in Mexico, fewer Mexicans will migrate. That just seems logical.
Well, what's happened in that period of time is that the number of illegal immigrants, not all of them certainly from Mexico, have risen to 20 million people in this country. The exodus from Mexico, we now have 10% of Mexico's population in our country. Their growth, their birth rate in Mexico is double, more than double, that of the United States. I mean, there are a host of reasons for us to do intelligent things in terms of the Mexican economy. But first and foremost among them is to just deal with the reality. It is a developing nation, and it cannot be dealt with as if there are no infrastructure problems, societal problems in Mexico, to treat Mexico as if it's the same as Canada or treat it as if it's the same thing as the Dominican Republic or Venezuela or Brazil or China. These are unique and distinct nations with disparate cultures and economies. And the United States pursues policies as if they're all some sort of cut out of the same template, and they are not.
Well, Lou, thanks a lot for being with us. Exporting America is the book. It was interesting talking to you. Take care of yourself.
Take care. Thanks. And come back and see us, huh?
I'd be delighted to anytime.
Okay, right. Bye-bye. It's 47 past the hour. We will be back after this break with some closing thoughts and some cliff notes for today's broadcast.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
801-GAME. That's 1-800-801-GAME. Call now. 1-800-801-GAME.
All right, it's 52 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Thou shalt not kill.
Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ass. That's the Ten Commandments by the Fugs, which we've gotten in our head all day today.
I don't know why.
We got to land this show. Boy, I'm going to be in Cincinnati tomorrow. It's going to be wild, man. I'm just going to be sitting there talking to you guys while I'm in the
studio.
While
you're in
there.
Cincinnati.
Apparently it's done all the time in radio.
Hey, listen, while you're there,
yeah.
You think you can find that 100 mil that the somebody messed up over in Iraq?
Yeah, I don't know who's got that money.
No one knows who's got that money.
You knew that was going to happen, though. All that money has been, all the kickbacks from Iraq, I can't even imagine how much dough that is. Even when the troops first got there,
yes.
You just saw bricks of American money just laying around.
Cash. They let a guy distribute this money after they had supposedly fired him. For embezzling the money.
So many people, just it's so amazing. Many awful people made millions and millions of dollars doing, and they're still doing it. But this is not just like Halliburton and Bechtel and
yeah.
Corporations. You know that individuals were involved. You know that money was funneled out of that country. It was just like, just cut and
Let's
run.
Let's start a company, man. Let's call it Marmar Incorporated.
And then what do we do?
We sign up and look, we do two things. One, we ask for a PR contract for something that we don't believe in but we can sell anyway. And then we ask for some kind of contract in Iraq too.
This is this weird Riley thing that he does sometimes when he sees, like, you know, who do we see on TV? Was it Tavis Smiley or somebody?
Yeah.
And you're like, we're in the wrong damn business.
That's right, man. No, it was Armstrong, man. Armstrong got $240,000. They've never given me that much.
Larry Elder.
Yeah, oh, him. That Noah. Look, if he still got a show.
I don't even know.
God, I can't stand.
I don't even
you
know.
Should take responsibility. You're mama's responsibility. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
Tomorrow we got a pretty good show tomorrow. I'll be in Cincinnati. It'll be a Go Bananas Friday and Saturday night. I'll be broadcasting out of 1530 WCKY, the Revolution of Talk Radio. Tomorrow we got comedian Martin Short's going to be with us.
Yeah.
Stephen Johnson, the author of Everything Bad Is Good For You.
Yeah.
Proops, Greg Proops is probably going to be on. Probably. What am I saying?
Probably. He will be.
He's definitely going to be on. He's in England. They love him in England.
Yeah.
Greg Proops, of course, he's a comedian. You've seen him on Whose Line Is It Anyway? And you've seen him on other things. He hosts things. He wears glasses. He talks quickly. He sounds kind of like this. That's a bad Proops. For those of you who are just tuning in or didn't get to hear the whole show, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. ABC is producing a miniseries on modern terrorism. The White House said it knew nothing about the planned miniseries, despite the fact that Condoleezza Rice was given a complete briefing titled ABC Determined to Make Miniseries About Terrorists. Lindy England's guilty plea is in question. In her defense, fellow soldiers told the court that Private England gave prisoners plenty of off-leash time and often gave them a can of wet food to keep them, the fur shiny. Yeah, okay. Testifying on Private England's behalf was convicted abuser Charles Grainer, who is serving a 10-year sentence. He fathered a child with England, but a military court determined that he still deserved further punishment. A student was arrested, for vulgar comments during an Ann Coulter speech in Austin. Coulter threatened to leave if the police did not remove the hecklers. She even took her broom out and put her key in the ignition. Hello. The witch joke. The witch. Al-Qaeda's number three guy was arrested in Pakistan. Man, if they keep catching these number threes, like, let's say, if we catch, like, 10,000 more number threes, we'll eventually have everybody but the top two.
There you go.
That's pretty good. Sucks to be promoted in Al-Qaeda, I'll tell you. So that's your Morning Sedition cliff notes for today.
Wow.
So, Chris, you're not going to the softball game tonight? What's going on? Air America. The Air America Jim Earls needs you there. Is there a problem? What do you got going?
Uh-oh.
The game starts at 7 p.m.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's really hard for me to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and then go, you know, do my job. You know, I'm on air for 7 hours.
Yeah.
And then I have to do something. And then I have to, what, nap? And then go back into the city.
Wine.
Dude, what position do you play? How are they going to fill it?
I don't know. The way Dan has it worked out, I think I'm playing DH at this point.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, there's no shame in this, are you? I mean, you're not ashamed of what happened last week, are you?
I got a base hit in an RBI. Like, you know, I was one of the highlights of our Air America team. You're not that same, my friend.
Tonight he'll be playing for Vanity Fair.
You're being bullied by Bashman and P.W. McDonald in the booth. They're concerned.
With the violin.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be hard for them. Maybe you should rethink this.
I'm definitely going to try to make it. If I do make it, I expect to be high up in the batting order, not 18th. Like I was last time.
18th?
Yeah. 18.
How many people are on
a 9-man team?
Oh, my God.
Well, tomorrow.
I'll be in Cincinnati.
Marin in Cincinnati. Martin Short on the air. Greg Proops from England. My God, do we have enough show for these people or what?
And some funny
on top of that. All for you tomorrow on Air America Radio. Have a good one, Marin.
You too, Riley.